Welcome back to The Rate of Change with York Wealth Management. As advisors to some of the wealthiest families in the country, The Rate of Change is a podcast designed to help you in the pursuit of building long-term wealth through the insights of some of the brightest minds in asset management. Today, we are joined by someone who's been on the podcast before, Jason Coggins. He has been ahead of the curve for years and essentially in asset management and private credit. Jason has advised many institutions and currently works with some institutions, family offices and fund managers, and has helped them manage multiple cycles and consistently identify turning points in credit quality, liquidity, market structure, you know, well before they're obvious. Bit of fun. Many listeners will remember 2020 when the markets were a bit rattled. Jason said private credit would hold, and he was right. In today's podcast, we're looking at the real state of, you know, AI, large language models, and the dramatically accelerating business creation that's happening, and what's happening with the legacy that's come before it, and more importantly, the debt, the private credit, you know, which has been one of the largest booming sectors in the States, but it's also, you know, underpinning the, you know, what's going to happen essentially with that debt. So, in saying that, Jason, great to have you back on. You know, I always love chatting to you on the air and off the air, and. But for many listeners who are familiar with your work and those who are not, I do just want to give a bit of an overview of, you know, who you are, what you do, and the types of groups that you're currently working with. And, mate, feel free to plug them away, because there's some pretty credible institutions and family offices you're currently working with.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. I really appreciate being given the opportunity to come back on, and absolutely echo I enjoy speaking to you. It's great debating ideas. This industry is all about sharing information, right? So I spent probably the longest part of my career in private wealth. And so providing advice to advisors and their clients, both families, individuals, and charities. Before that, I worked at big banks, ANZ. I worked at consultancy firms. After my decade at Coda Capital, I decided I wanted to do something different, right? I thought there has to be something different that still leverages my skills. I love investing. I love markets. I'm an economist. I want to be involved in that, but I wanted to do it from a different angle. And what was so fortunate is that I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So I stuck around Coda for a little while, and then people kind of offered consultancy gigs to me. And I thought, this is interesting. Maybe I don't need to go to a full-time role. I can just work with a bunch of different people who don't compete necessarily, but where I can almost have 1 + 1 + 1 = 6, right? Because I can share the insights from different organizations. Today, what I'm working on, and I'm going to do an alphabetical order because I don't want to pick favorites, but I work with a group called Aura. So Calvin and Eric's business, private markets based in Singapore and Sydney. I love those boys. I think they've done an amazing job and super intelligent. The industry only produces great investors every decade, and I definitely think they're one of them. I also do strategy, and I manage their balance sheet for Aura. Elliston Capital, very long legacy, huge intellectual capital in this business. Elliston, you know, long legacy of, you know, the Packer family office, Ashok Jacob, who is one of the best, if not the best investors in the marketplace. I help those guys on strategy and also distribution on how they should message what is probably the best small cap team in the market and an amazing private markets platform. I also work with a group in the US, IBEX Investors, which is a technology hybrid fund, public and private. And then I'm very fortunate to have been invited by Chris Cuff, who's one of the godfathers of the finance industry. I help on the investment committee for Australian Philanthropic Services and also Third Link. So there's a few things going on, but they all kind of work together in a strange way.
Love it. The other interesting thing we should discuss is very interesting in our industry, is I've found when I was in the industry, you know, people think as employees a little bit. And I found a lot of advisors historically just recommend things, but then you look at their own portfolio, it's completely different to what they're telling their clients, right? We've discussed this, you know, at length. Yeah. And what I quite like what you do, Jason, is a lot of those firms which you mentioned, would you agree that, you know, it speaks to, you know, how you feel about markets and how you're investing your own cash? So essentially your money is where your mouth is. Would you say that's a fair statement?
Yep. 100%. And look, I didn't want to bring up some of the advice firms that I sit on investment committees because obviously you're an advisor, so I didn't want to plug those guys, but I still enjoy working with great advisors. And if you look on my LinkedIn, you can see who I work with. And I think there's this huge issue in the marketplace, right? And, you know, I think Paul Heath at Coda really drummed this into me quite well, is if you're recommending product, if you're recommending strategies to families and to individuals, then you should probably invest in those yourself. And I think there is an inherent conflict in the industry that there's a lot of people who recommend stuff but don't put their own money in a product. So every one of those firms I work for, I invest in their strategies because I believe in them. And I would probably, say that if you have an advisor, you want to ask them, where's your money? Like when I look at a fund manager, the first thing I ask is, well, how much money do you have in your own fund? I also ask them, another good question is, if you weren't putting more money in your own fund, what's another fund that you would put money in? And it's amazing the kind of good ideas you get from that.
So true. Couldn't have said it better myself. Why don't we get into the guts of it today? There's a lot to cover here. Yeah. Where should we start? We always start with private credit. So why don't we start with the fun stuff, right? You know, there is a lot moving, you know, with the acceleration in AI, these large language models. You know, there's the boom, I think, you know, that's happening, you know, in the crypto space, right? And you know, what's happening, you know, with this space? Because I think some of the friends that you've been talking to, steal the thunder, but one of your mates was saying that a software as a service business, how long did it take for him to build it, you know? And now these AI models are here and what they build in 3 months or something crazy. So what's happening with this space?
There's so many parts to that question. So let's think about just the basic macro around private credit. There's a lot of noise around private credit and some of it's justified, but so long as there's two massive tailwinds supporting that sector, you know, the desire for people to have income, you know, as we move from accumulation in superannuation to deaccumulation, people will want more income, right? The second other aspect is that banks are not lending as much in non-traditional areas. They're two powerful tailwinds that are not going to change. Now, absolutely, ASIC has a role and regulators around the world to stress test this asset class, but I debate anybody who says there's a systemic event occurring where there's broad brush defaults. Yes, we've had some fraudulent activity. Yes, we've had some highly aggressive funds blow up. But by and large, this is not a systemic event, right? So I think the private credit thematic is still playing out and it will continue. The real question is, you know, it's very easy to write a loan. How do you enforce a loan? How do you protect capital? How do you get your money back? That will differentiate good managers from bad managers. But anybody, and you know, journalists love writing about this stuff, but I would say that the risks are valid, but I think they're definitely overplayed. Now, to your question where I'm spending a lot of time trying to understand and speaking to way smarter people than me, like in tech, right? You know, that's our role as researchers, right? Associate ourselves with smarter people and ask for insights from them. I am getting deeply concerned that there's large parts, and it's not just private credit, it's private equity, particularly in the US, right? You've got a lot of these legacy SaaS businesses. You've got a lot of legacy business service businesses. And you made that point about months, right? To create a business, you know, a SaaS business, I don't know what the metric is, but maybe it's, you know, to get to $1 million of, or, you know, $1 billion of annual recurring revenue, it would take 33 months, right? So, you know, just, you know, nearly 3 years. To do that now with AI-enabled companies, it's like one quarter of that time. Now, I asked the private equity manager, what does that mean? They're like, oh, that's fine. All of our companies are going to start using AI, so it's great. And I said, well, that's not the question I really asked. If you can rebuild these businesses at one-tenth of the cost, they outcompete you. And these legacy companies that are held by large private equity firms and some private debt firms, you know, these are legacy SaaS businesses. These are legacy business services businesses that are going to be disrupted. Now, I'm not saying that's a systemic event for private equity or private credit, but the pace of change that you will see from a sector perspective is going to be nothing like we've seen in the past. And so that has to shape how you invest. That has to shape where you invest. And you've got to be cognizant. Like AI is going to fundamentally change industries. And if you're not prepared for it, your portfolio is going to be at risk.
But it's just so vast, this AI space. You hear Elon Musk discuss it as well. Like, it's like a black box. You know, no one actually knows. And who was it? One of your mates was saying as well, he reckons, like, what is it, nearly 80 or 85% of growth, all growth in the next 10 years, like more millionaires and billionaires are going to be made in the next 10 years than ever before. Like, you know.
Yep.
So there's always, what I would really want to get into, yes, there's the opportunity. Everyone's excited. Let's go bang, bang, bang. Yep. But there's also the dirty underbelly as well. That's what's going to get left behind. Like, if look at, like, we're chatting with Eric, right? Eric's been on the podcast, great guy, right? And he was even discussing it. You know, they've got the fund, you know, which is going after, you know, finding AI, legitimate, you know, AI businesses that actually provide a solution to a problem. Meanwhile, he's fending off all these other pitch decks where they're legacy businesses trying to add on something that is AI, then coming across as AI. Like, I don't know where to start with this, mate. You're better at this than I am, but this entire space is so interesting. The opportunity, but then everyone's trying to catch up at the same time.
Yeah. I think there's two parts to that, right? So if you think about AI and the importance that that has for an economy, I honestly think when Trump came in the second term, he realized with the tech bros that they were behind China, right? So China spent a lot of time building cheap energy, which, you know, feeds data centers and feeds this new industrial complex, right? And so I think there's a collusion between the private and public sector, where the public sector has said, we'll back you, but you got to spend the money and you got to win, right? And it's similar to the 1980s with chips and Japan, right? There was a collusion between the private and public sector in the US to outcompete Japan, and they ultimately won. And AI is really this winner-takes-all market, in my view. So I think the US saw that they were behind. 60 to 80% of their GDP now is linked to CapEx-related activity in digital enablement and data centers, right? So they, and this is the thing, like, you go, well, should I be overweight the US? Well, you know, this thematic is going to play out over another 2 to 3 years, right? And I think the US is looking at this and going, we may blow up the economy in the short term. Overinvest, inflation, but we want to win the AI war for the next 30 years, right? So again, that throws up, how the hell do you invest? Now, to your other question on seed, right? Seed investments. I do think that AI and the changes, it's a winner-takes-all market, right? Like a lot of sectors. I don't know if that's regionally, like I think China, US, separate systems, but you know, within a lot of these markets, it'll be a winner-takes-all market for AI. And so the only way you can get exposure efficiently to this change is actually in seed investments, in my opinion. If you're in later stage, you know, really later stage AI tech, then you're probably going to be overpaying and competing against really big GPs who can pay, you know, at any price. The great thing about seed is that they're really early, right? And you know, you only need a couple of winners. So again, the changes here are, you know, there's a winner-takes-all market, I think, in this whole thematic. The US wants to win AI. I'm not sure they can. I think China's as good, if not better, and they're definitely further ahead in feeding this. And then seed. I think if you want to be part of this investment thematic, it's really the best way to get exposure to it.
Let's unpack the seed part, right? Because remember everyone loved an IPO back in the days. Mate, I was a stockbroker 15, 20 years ago. It's all the rage. Yeah. But these days, what, past 3-4 years, it looks like nearly every single IPO that's come out has pretty much lost money to an extent, right? Don't quote me on that. Mm. Go check the boards. But I think a very, very high percentage, you know, has been down the other side. Do you think that's predominantly because the markets have just been, you know, it's a hard market? Or do you think the comment we've heard thousands of times, which is, you know, stay private for longer. The good businesses are trying to stay private for longer, and then they just get bought out by an absolute major. Is that what you're referring to by, you know, if you want to get into these AI businesses, no one knows which one it's going to be. Like, you remember like Afterpay and Zip, and who the hell is going to be the next one? Nobody knows, right? It's Russian, you know, there's 20 companies, you know, fighting for a piece of the pie that it may only take 3 businesses. You know what I mean? So like, is that what you're saying? Like, you know, how the hell do you know? You're better off kind of buying up, getting in early with C, getting a basket and see what happens.
So, yeah, look, when I say seed is potentially the option to get exposure to the sector, I'm not saying go put 50% of your portfolio in seed, right? I just think it's, you know, a famous investor, he started a tech business in Australia. He's probably one of the older tech guys. He's not in his 30s or 20s. He increasingly is using seed funds to hedge the risk on his later stage SaaS businesses, right? And he said, Jason, I just don't understand if these businesses will be around, his like later stage SaaS businesses. He says they're going to be outcompeted by new companies. They're going to be outcompeted by, and you know, I use this example, but I get sued for defamation, but like Grammarly, right? Or Grammarly, like that was that the last raise they did like 2 to 3 years ago was $19 billion, right? USD. There's private equity firms in there. I'm sure there's private debt in there as well to fund these businesses. Does Grammarly have a future when ChatGPT can do that for free? Like this is the kind of pace of change. That's a $19 billion company, right? You see all their advertising on YouTube all the time. But $19 billion when ChatGPT and Claude and all the others, the AI tools do that now for free. So it's the pace of change, right? It's so fast. In terms of the IPO market, I think there's still an indigestion problem. You know, if you look at the US market, the number of private companies that need to be IPO'd is extreme. You know, Australia should be the best IPO market, right? We have the lowest cost of capital in the world. What I mean by that is there is a huge amount of superannuation money that just feeds into the system every month. You know, companies should trade on higher multiples here, smaller companies, not bigger companies, but smaller companies, because the market is so starved for growth. But I still think the quality of companies that have been listed has not been that great. And so, you know, small caps have performed extremely well. Like up until this week, there's been a bit of a sell-off, but small caps are the best part of the market. You know, 10% earnings growth, gold was shooting the lights out. But we still haven't had that big IPO push. Lower interest rates should support that. Obviously, we have a huge inflation problem in this country. Like, inflation is diabolical in this country. Our maximum, kind of growth before inflation kicks in is not high. And so we need to address some of those productivity improvements. I know I'm going around in circles, but, you know, if you're in a low growth economy with terrible productivity and high inflation, I think the only way to make money is smaller companies. They're less linked to what I call macro beta, right? So banks or the insurers or the supermarkets, all they've got going for them is cutting costs, right? That's the only way to grow earnings per share. And I think you'd be surprised if you look at the top 50 companies, how many from an earnings per share basis are still behind 2007 levels, right? Before the financial crisis. I think the only way to generate growth is number one, thinking about AI and its implications, and two, investing in small companies that are capital light or labor light and are not GDP linked.
It's easier said than done, right? Like to your point, you know, Grammarly's huge. Like how many businesses have the same scenario like Grammarly? Like, you know what I mean? How many are out there, you know, with this potential debt overhang and then that potentially are all in these managed funds that people are investing in, you know, across the masses. And then people aren't like, how do you know essentially, and how can you, you know, risk manage and, you know, try to defend against a potential, you know, debt cliff. And, you know, all of a sudden you wake up in the morning and someone's created a copycat or, you know, improved upon your thing at the fraction of a price. And then your business is now defunct. So, you know, if people are like, they're listening to you, you're going, yes, now is probably one of the most exciting times to hit small cap companies. They're going to go. But, you know, like how do you pick which one? Because it's just changing so fast.
It's changing so fast. And I think the companies like, you know, I'm going to use an example in Australia, like Myob or Xero, right? Very sticky, very sticky. It's too hard to change services, right? I could think of nothing worse than trying to understand how I would untangle my business from Myob, right? So I think those businesses are fine, but there's a whole bunch of other businesses, in business services and SaaS that can be replicated, like you said. And so I think my role is, you know, to stress test the managers and ask them about this. And, you know, there was a manager that I saw a couple of weeks ago and I just said, like, what are you thinking about this? And it's, again, they hadn't even thought about it. Now, I think the next 10 years is going to be some of the most significant change we've ever seen. And if your managers aren't on top of it, you're going to have some problems. Like, I don't know
No, that's all right. Let's stay on the AI side. So from what you've heard, you know, what like people listening go, AI, it sounds great, but what the hell is AI? You know, how does a business incorporate it? Like, what, like what is it? Because Eric discussed it as well, right? You know, what is a very good example of, you know, using AI to essentially create a service, to essentially create one of these businesses? What's a good example?
Yeah, I think a very good example is, you know, the initial work in accounting, in legal, in all these repetitive kind of tasks, right? If you can automate that, you know, I think that's going to change a business. Now, I was speaking to a business in Canberra, a consultancy business, and you know, AI and consulting is not a great analogy with the Deloitte issue. But what they said was AI will be great because it's not ready to displace our consultants, but we'll definitely know the consultants who are using AI to improve their productivity versus those who do not use it to improve their productivity. So I think the industries most at risk are definitely those repeat industries, accounting, legal, even to some degree investment management, right? Like there's a lot of that can be automated. But, you know, if I was a kid now, I would be wanting to understand how I use AI to get ahead because a traditional, like an analyst, right? I was working with one of the advice groups I work on the investment committee, right? And, you know, investing is art and science, right? The science aspect is just collating the information and putting it at a table and looking at the metrics, right? That can be all automated. The art is the experience of investing, right? And looking at that and going, well, the AI actually went a bit crazy. That's not right, right? The science aspect will be completely automated. The art will still be required. Now, the problem is that if you don't train people to do the science, how can they get to know the art? So again, that transition period for the next 10 years is going to be fascinating because the traditional path to be an analyst or the traditional path to be an accountant or the traditional path to be a legal professional is going to fundamentally change, right? It's not going to be the same path of experience, grunt work, because the grunt work will be done by AI.
That's so true. Like think about the schools. It's all essentially, you know, tick a box, questionnaires, you know, rote learn, you know, punch it out. But these days, you know, if you use ChatGPT, I use ChatGPT all the time or Grok or some equivalent, everyone does, right? The art of using these things is how do you code? How do you feed information in that's accurate so it doesn't spit out nonsense, right? And then it's practically a comprehension exam, right? The ability to inject, understand, interpret, and ensure that it's actually achieved the right outcome. And then in doing so, instead of taking 8 hours, you can punch the thing out in 30 minutes or an hour. So yeah, it's just, 100%. It's mind-boggling about, you know, how much this is going to boom. And the other thing, actually, we went to the Oracle conference, was it on Tuesday night, which was great. That was brilliant, down in Botanic Gardens. And I think one of the main things they were discussing there was how this COVID generation has all these young people. They don't necessarily, you know, like the idea of, you know, working for a major anymore, you know, being an employee. They're all about the job economy, you know, being an entrepreneur. You know, do you think that the boom in this essentially, you know, so it's called AI or tech space, is really driven by the underbelly and essentially the kids getting into the workforce? Because they're not getting into the workforce. They're like carving out their own little part of in their room or a bunch of friends and kind of having a crack. And companies like, you know, you know, Squarespace, you know, what's it called, Stripe, all these companies, you know, are really benefiting from this. Do you think there's a massive, you know, wave of, you know, academic, you know, powerhouse punching into these markets that will essentially support this, you know, push that we're seeing in this mark kind of part of the market?
I think there's different ways to look at that. I think there's definitely the risk of displacement, right? But I'm quite optimistic that the world changes and changes for the better, right? But if a kid's sitting there thinking that the traditional path of what their parents did to get ahead, it's just not going to work, right? And so I go back to that point, the next 10 years is going to be extremely challenging, but there's going to be huge opportunities. You know, there's plenty of pathways that this AI and adoption of AI can go, right? It can improve productivity around the economy, you know, the global economy by a massive factor, but it can also cut large parts of the labor market out. And you are starting to see wobbling, and the data in the US is not great because of the shutdown, but you are starting to see some kind of commentary around, you know, job losses, particularly in that early part of someone's career. I think it was JP Morgan or Goldman Sachs. They have a ratio of senior managing directors to junior staff, and they're going to halve that. So that's half the number of jobs for junior analysts in that business. I think it was JP Morgan. It could have been Goldman Sachs, but I think it's JP Morgan. So you're starting to see AI's impact on the employment market. And that's only accelerating. I mean, I saw, you know, there was an article, I thought, you know, it was like written like a month ago, and it was actually written 2 years ago, and it just like it completely underestimated the impact even 2 years ago on what was going on. And this article was talking about that 25% of jobs could be lost, existing jobs. Now, obviously, there'll be new jobs created, but 25% of all jobs in the US economy are at risk of being outcompeted or replaced by artificial intelligence.
That's crazy. But if you think about historically, right, everyone said the same thing after the Industrial Revolution. You know, the internet came along. You know, Nokia was, Nokia existed. Now it doesn't. You know, you know, there are numerous industries, you know, that come and go, but essentially people still manage to survive. But I suppose this really gets into cycles, right? And let's get into the fun part. You and I love discussing strategy, the cycles, the whole point of my podcast name, The Rate of Change, is essentially identifying the cycles, because essentially money doesn't vanish. It just kind of, it cycles up, everyone makes a lot of capital, then it leaves one asset class, and then essentially one door closes, another one opens, and then essentially enters into another part of the asset class. So right now with the cycle, where in that cycle do you think we are?
Yeah, I think there's debating this with one of my close friends who I worked with, a coder, Bridget Leckie. And, you know, we kind of probably started October thinking there'd be another melt up. Obviously, there's been some wobbles and the market's not really pushing ahead higher and higher. It's going, you know, kind of bubbling around. I think people are starting to look at valuations and going, there's a lot of good news priced into markets. But I go back to that point, like the CapEx boom in the US, which is on the basis that the US wants to win the AI war or come close to winning it, that's going to help the market. That spending is not going away. So where I think we're in the cycle, I think, you know, it's hard, like on any fundamental basis, markets, particularly in the US, are not cheap. But they're going to be funded for growth through this CapEx boom and AI boom. And so I wouldn't discount there's still potential for a melt up in markets. You know, large caps in Australia, like these are really, really awful organizations, right? They're not growing the top line. They are at the front and center of the productivity issues in these in this economy. And the only way these large companies can grow earnings is by cutting costs. So look, the cycle is an interesting one, but every cycle is different. You know, my approach to investing is, you know, just keep searching for new ideas, find fund managers that are in a very niche part of the market where they have some type of repeatable competitive edge in sourcing, in originating, in managing. You know, I would probably be cautious on kind of a broad index-based approach at the moment.
Yeah, so we need to dig into this. I want to get into the private credit side, of course, but just whilst we're on the growth topic, everyone's been reading the news. Essentially, people that aren't X, you can't see it. The States is an interesting one, right? You know, it's funny. Love him or hate him, Trump essentially said he was going to do a thing and then did a thing, right? So the tariffs have come through, right? So I'm just curious in your opinion, what's been the main impact of the tariffs? The Doge team has identified all the fraud and essentially stopped a whole bunch of money coming through. It was one of the main reasons for the government shutdown, trying to stop the funding of the, you know, in those blue states, you know, have the means to essentially give, you know, illegal immigrants, you know, $10,000 gift cards and put them up at the best hotels. They're trying to kill all that, you know, love it or hate it. So that's happening. But meanwhile, you also have, you know, money coming back into, you know, over in the US, like trying to feed and build up the middle class, which is what the Chinese have done phenomenally well for the past 30, 40 years, right? They've built up their middle class. And then you can see the benefits of that. You know, that's all come through to Australia. That's not really happening in Australia. And then the other thing as well, which is very interesting, you know, even his son, Barron Trump, they are, you know, in their entire that network, they're really building out this digital asset space. Right, but meanwhile, if you look over in the UK and other areas, they're trying to do it to control people. Meanwhile, in the US market, they're trying to build out the digital space because they know there's so much debt there. They're discussing potentially paying it back with digital assets. You know what I mean? So, it's very interesting that we have many different thematics happening on a global scale. So I suppose why I'm asking the cycle question is, some people, like one advisor, you know, is running a lot of money, like $800 million, great bloke. You know, he's sitting half in cash, you know, because we know that this market runs up, then comes off, and you know what I mean? So he's sitting in cash because he's looking at one particular part of the market. Meanwhile, one part, a very large part of the market's doing incredibly well, other parts are suffering, you know what I mean? Some are mid-stage. Yeah. So that's why it's, I don't know how to answer this question or where to dig into it, because there's just so, it's like there's, it's not just two speeds, it's like a five speed economy happening on a global scale.
I think always be skeptical, be a contrarian. If everybody's chasing flashy new lights and the new thing, that's probably a risk. I think it's dangerous sitting in cash, right? Like, it could be very dangerous. Markets on average go up a lot over the long term, but also recognize that the drawdown can be pretty severe, but you got to constantly learn. What I love about my roles now is I'm involved in different organizations. You know, the Aura guys are so integrated into Asia and the local VC sector here, and also private credit. Elliston has got their fingers everywhere, right? They see a lot. They've been in markets, you know, for 40, 50 years. The Ibex guys see technology, both in the US and Israel. So I see a bunch of different things, right? And you just got to keep stress testing and keep learning, and don't get too caught in some of the biases that some investors have, right? And just be like, accept that you can be different, right? You don't have to follow what everybody else is doing. And also challenge, like, you know, this, we spoke about private credit before. Again, you know, and I say this, I know the journalists who write these articles. Tell me where the systemic risk is, and don't point to me to outright fraud like Shield or, you know, some really, really risky funds. Tell me where the risk is. Like, I don't care what the paper says. Where is the actual risk? There's definitely needs to be more transparency on that sector, and there needs to be, you know, a lot more information provided to clients. But tell me where the systemic risk is. I mean, I'll be honest, like 35 to 40% of my portfolio is in private credit. I'm not seeing it. Right now, of course, when you're earning 9 to 10%, of course there's going to be individual loans that don't go so well, right? That's why I'm earning 9 to 10%, but I'm not seeing broad systemic risk. And just remember, 2007 and 2008 and 2009 was very different. That was leverage credit. That was, you know, collateralized debt obligations with 2 to 3% subordination, but very heavy industry concentration in home builders, in second tier banks, in Icelandic banks, right? You know, you had 20 times leverage. That's not what you see now. I think what's also important, and I'm not going to say what I think is better or worse, but, you know, the Australian private debt market is very different to the US private debt market, despite what the media is saying. I mean, the media is saying, oh, Aussie's worse. Well, actually, we have better creditor rights, way better creditor rights. We don't need to go to courts to enforce a loan, right? In the US, you have to go to a court to enforce a loan. That results in extremely low recovery rates. Right, the Australian market is also the Australian market is also very short duration. It is a bridge financing market, right? So the average loaner is 6 to 12 months. The US market is typically direct lending, cash flow lending, right, to corporates that are highly leveraged and owned by private equity firms. What also is a very different characteristic is a lot of the funds in Australia for global private credit had leverage in them. Like, we're talking about fund leverage, one-to-one, right? So not only are you buying private equity companies with, you know, a lot of leverage, the fund has leverage. Now, I'm not saying it's bad or good, but it's not apples and apples. So, you know, stress test what you're hearing in the marketplace, constantly try and learn about these asset classes and be prepared to be different.
Let's get really into that, because, you know, I love this private credit stuff, because – well, like, in my background's currency, I was always taught from an early age, follow the money. If you follow the money, then essentially you can see the outcome before it potentially happens, right? So with private credit, what's actually happening in Australia now? There's been, you know, change to regulation. Some people say that, you know, it's, you know, you don't even need a license to do it. But the other thing is, it's just patterns. It's the same thing over and over again, right? You know, you have a new industry that opens up. When I was in foreign currency, I was 20 years too late. You know, it began with the spreads of 2%. You know, it all began, same thing with private credit, like foreign currency. It was a bank-based product, you know, only. And then essentially said the banks didn't want to do it anymore, or they opened the door to private markets. Then you see the first wave, which is predominantly the people that left the banks, set up the things, then off they go. Then you get the middleman brokers realizing how much money is in it. And then, you know, it keeps going and going. But as that happens, just naturally with every single business, competition increases, margins compress, right? The boom explodes. Then you have less supply in the market of quality loans, and then people start chasing things. And the other thing, which is interesting from the GFC, people aren't familiar with this, and we discuss it, you know, at length. The thing that nearly killed everyone in the GFC wasn't necessarily the banks going under. It was the insurance company AIG, which nearly had, don't quote me on this, was 80 or 85% of the entire market's paper. If they went under, every single loan that was written on isn't worth the paper that it's written on. And then meanwhile, you had the blatant fraud with Moody's, which is potentially happening now. I'm not saying it is, but in the AFR, they're discussing it with, you know, ASIC, they're having a big look at it, where these, not ratings agencies, but these valuation agencies, right? You know, what's happening with the conflict of interest? Yeah, Christ, it's just a rabbit hole. It's interesting what you're just discussing. At one point, you have, you know, AI growth, the markets are hammering. You would say that it's, there's this credit space is really matured, right? But, you know, people are discussing now that there is some form of an underbelly, like reminiscent of 05, 06, starting to poke its head out. You know, and what's currently happening with the Australian market?
Here's one for you, right? Now, I'm a believer in technology, and I'm a believer that AI will change the entire world for the better in most parts, assuming that employment market isn't destroyed in the meantime. But, you know, let's just say I'm wrong, right? Let's say I'm wrong. And let's say that the trillions of dollars that the Mag 7 are investing in AI ends up worthless, right? We're talking about, you know, seven of the largest companies in the world potentially throwing money down the drain, right? They're now raising debt. So I'm not saying that that's the base case, but there is a plausible scenario that in 10 years' time, we look back and go, holy hell, that was like the biggest scam ever. Like, you don't know the next crisis, right? We didn't know what 2008 would look like. Yeah, debt was going up. There was some sexy creative structures. There was a lot more leverage in the system, but leverage is increasing. Now, again, I believe in AI and I believe in the technology change that will occur. But let's say, you know, there was a great chart that says, you know, for every $1 billion of revenue, how much does Meta need to spend? And it's like literally going like that now. So I think like an economist, right? Decision trees and probability tables, right? There's not a 0% probability that this is all worthless, right? So I think we need to consider that as a potential risk, that the amount of money that's being spent is not efficient. Now, but then I got to that point about having to win. Like, I think the US, when Trump came in and said, we have to win, it was like the railways, right? Just spend as much money as you can. I don't care if the economy goes into recession for 2 to 3 years. We are playing a 30 to 50 year game and we want to beat China. And so, you know, I think that they will pump and dump this CapEx boom, and there'll be some point where it definitely blows up. But the US is not worried about having a recession for a year or two. They want to win the 30-year game that is AI.
So how does that – yeah, I understand the growth side, but on the private credit front with where we are right now, how does that – because, okay, we're discussing off air, right? You know, you were saying essentially private credit, bridging loans, the Australian method, happy days as long as they're asset-backed. Yeah. Right, but essentially, you're just starting to question. Even though there's fantastic lenders out in the market, we know them very well. You know, they work directly with businesses. But you know, if that pop does happen, which one will potentially get a hit first? You know, an asset-backed loan or essentially a business loan?
So for me, and I'm going to ignore the domestic versus global. Everything's in the capital stack, right? So if there is uncertainty in markets, then I'd rather be higher up the capital stack. So again, I go back to that point before, the two tailwinds for private credit: people want it, the banks aren't doing it, and the economy needs it. But also, in a period of high valuations in markets, being higher up the cap stack is actually quite attractive. But in saying that, of course, there's going to be some segments of private credit that don't do so well, right? We're going to have instances of fund managers that don't do so well. And we're going to have instances of individual loans not doing well. But, you know, by and large, I think private credit still remains a nice place to sit, you know, for a large part of the portfolio. Like, getting your 8 to 9 to 10%, maybe 10 is a little bit more aggressive, but your 8 to 9% And, you know, I remember being criticized time and time again in 2021, 2022. Jason, why don't you have government bonds? You need government bonds. It's like, why would I buy government bonds when the duration is like 7 to 8 years, interest rates are 1%. There's no upside there. What have government bonds done over the last decade? Like zero, nothing. And on an inflation adjusted basis, that's terrible. So, you know, yeah, we were early in private credit. We have hybrid received notes, a lot gone. Of criticism and
bank, you know, hybrid.
Oh, yeah, that's going to be
hybrid notes gone. Everyone like, Jesus Christ, you're at a stockbroking yep. house. They used to pump the CBO pearls and ANZ yep. and all that type of stuff. You know what I mean? They're yep. gone. So yep. the question, 100%. I suppose this is actually a very important question. Like, you know, there are investors out there. I can't remember how many billions of dollars are now in private credit, right? And how many billions of dollars are in superannuation? How much, sorry?
I think it's 220 billion. I think the media talks about local market being about $220 billion. Which is not
super like or in the private credit.
What, 1.5 trillion? Private credit. And maybe 3 or 4 trillion in super.
Well, let's get down to real economics. Like real home economics, right? Everyone says what's the inflation right now? In the threes? But if you look at true inflation, yep. like what it costs you for fuel, you know, food, like the real stuff, electricity, wouldn't yep. you agree? And you've told me this, that it's yep. it's actually property inflation. And what's property inflation for the past 20 years as an average?
Unfortunately, it's not just property inflation now. I mean, our governments are spending way too much money. We don't have productivity growth. You know, we had a 1% increase in the Trimmine measure, which is the preferred measure of inflation, takes away the volatile aspects. 1%, so it's like, you know, you're talking about a 4% core inflation rate. Like that's probably something that keeps me up most at night. Because, you know, our governments are not, and, you know, big part of that is infrastructure spending, probably the last decade in New South Wales, now a bit of, you know, Queensland and Victoria. But inflation's pretty bad. And that's just from, like, inflation is regressive, right? It hurts the bottom half of the people more than the top half of the people, right? So,
yeah, but mainstream, this is the thing, right? Inflation formula, they're saying, you know, 4, right? But when you're looking at affordability of houses, all this type of stuff, like, you know, this has been zone changing happens, right? You know, we've discussed it before and other people, you know, think that essentially it's property inflation. And where I'm going with this, right, is that if you're a retiree with 2 million, 3 million, you go to home, you know, you just need a plan for the next 20 years, you're 75 years old, you may live to 95, right? Well, simple math. If property inflation over the is hypothetically say 8% over 20 years, right? You can't make 4 because you're 4% behind every year compounding. So theoretically, you need to find an asset class where you can generate, you know, after fees, 8% just to be standing still. Is that an accurate, you know, just, you know, simple man test, reasonable man test, you know, observation? Because this is how a lot of these families are feeling. Like, you know, if, and the other thing as well is that to your point, government bonds don't work anymore. The good old, you know, the old way of doing it, you know, stick money in a term deposit doesn't really work anymore in order for them to essentially sustain their lifestyles. This is not personal advice, by the way. We're just discussing thematics.
Yeah. This is going to change tack, but kind of answer the question in a different way. Again, I was just off a phone call, right? And I sit on the, on an investment committee for, you know, credit fund, right? Aura. And, you know, one of the stress tests that I want to talk about, like we're talking about, you know, the expensive and prohibitively expensive cost of living and houses in Australia, right? But don't underestimate change, right? Like, you know, Auckland property prices, you know, fell nearly a quarter, right? 25%. Toronto, 18%.
Vancouver, yeah, but didn't New Zealand fall because she banned foreign money coming in though?
No, Auckland was all about supply. Toronto and Vancouver, population growth was stronger than Australia post-COVID, and they still have property prices decline. One of the concerns that I think you'll see, particularly, it's probably the only piece of reform this country's had, is the transport-oriented development legislation in, I don't think it's actually called that, but TOD sites in New South Wales, where you can effectively bypass councils, right? If you're within 800 metres of a transport hub, you can build like duplexes without any council approval, and if you're 400 meters near these TODs, you can build towers. Right now, that kind of is what happened in New Zealand, where you know, you're allowed to just increase supply massively. So the one outlier risk that I think in Australia is that house prices, particularly in New South Wales, where you're seeing this massive amount of supply, like you go around like all the eastern suburbs, Mosman, all these areas, they're consolidating these like houses and putting, you know, 100 apartments in. So I think the supply aspect could really throw a spanner in the works around property prices. Don't think property prices will always remain expensive, because we've seen three very similar markets, Auckland, Toronto, and Vancouver, all fall by up to a quarter, right? So again, like being an investor is thinking about the future and how it may change, not what has happened and what we're biased to believe in will continue to happen.
Stay flexible. Stay frosty, everyone. Stay frosty.
I don't understand the Vancouver and Toronto, not to be honest. Like, that was policy and some macroprudential policy, but that's a big drop, right? That's a big drop for a country that, you know, you think that, you know, population growth was strong in Australia over the last 3 years. Like, Canada was on another level, right? So, and still house prices fell a lot.
Yeah. So with the Australian market as well, you do have Brisbane's booming hard. Like, they keep expanding out each way, soaking up all that farmland, expand. But to your point, the Sydney market with the LMR, you know, the family offices I'm with, like I've even, you know, disclosed as well, personally invested in one of these things. The numbers are nuts. Like, we was literally like 10 days before it's worth X. And then on the next day, you know, the uplift was insane, just on paper, right? You know, people are cashing in, but the people we're speaking with, it's almost as if the booms happened. You know, people sold for the prices that they wanted. Now true numbers are starting to go, okay, is the valuation make sense? Just like probably what's happening with NVIDIA. Do the numbers make sense? Valuations start to soften, then supply hits the market, and then everyone looks and goes again. It's the same cycle for every single, you know, asset class. It's just understanding where we are in each particular cycle and where we should be allocating.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think there's no shortage of good ideas, right? You know, again, I'm very fortunate to work with some amazing people. And, you know, while markets are high and, you know, there's a lot of concerns around valuations, still an extraordinary number of ideas that are coming across our desk, right? Like the Aura boys, they bought this payments business, this HR payments business in the Philippines, and cash generative, growing at 40% per annum, paid a tiny multiple for it. Great asset. You know, the Ellison guys, you know, they obviously did the big Firmus cap raise.
Do you want to walk through that deal?
Data center. So it's a data center in Tasmania that has very, it's like a core weave technology where it's, you know, much cheaper in terms of power costs and also energy costs, right? Contracted revenue with NVIDIA. So, you know, it's almost de-risked. You know, these are managers I like working with, and both Aura and Ellison get access to deal flow that's quite interesting. The industrial growth side of the business in Ellison, they just bought infrastructure. We talked about Brisbane, right? They bought an infrastructure service business, CSEE, tiny multiple, right? But growing fast, obviously the Olympic boom. And so there's still ideas out there, right? There's still ideas out there. You know, the risk for single asset deals is obviously, you know, it's easy to get in, but how do you sell them, right? At the end, what's the exit? If you think exits are hard on like private equity funds, when you've got a single asset, it's even harder. But when I look at those three deals, like, they're all super interesting, and they're all leveraging not just the great business that we're investing in, but the people, right? The people. So the Ellison people, the Aura people, they're great originators. They're great. They've got a lot of structural protections in there. And, you know, particularly for the C asset, SEE, and Giftaway, which is the Filipino HR Giftaway technology, they're cash generative. So that's great. Like, owning cash, I'm not so worried, right? So there's definitely still ideas out there. This is the type of places that family offices want to invest in. So despite markets being at record highs, my approach to investing is I love buying stuff that's cheap, right? I love buying that stuff that's cheap and can go up a lot. And I'm also willing to go against the herd. So it takes a while to be proven right, but, you know, I don't need to follow the greatest fad at the moment. Like, there's so many ideas out there. And, you know, my idea is that, you know, it's slightly off topic, but, you know, alpha is available, but if it was truly easy, then it, you know, it wouldn't be there. So you know, to actually generate alpha, you've got to be different and you've got to be looking at things when other people are not looking at them. And if everybody's talking about, you know, a similar thing, then it's probably not the place you want to be in. And that's why, like, you know, I think, you know, again, I'm going to plug one of the groups I work for, but like, you know, VC in Australia, for example, I've had limited exposure in the past, but I think this cycle at the moment for VC spending back to that seed kind of focus and being able to harness AI, Australia also produces some fantastic, companies per dollar spent. So I think VC in the Australian market is actually going to be an attractive investment over the next 5 to 10 years. And there's some fantastic tax benefits as well. Like there's not many free lunches in terms of tax in Australia, but Australian VC funds are generally, if they meet certain criteria, are tax-free, both from capital and income. So I think you got to be different. You can't, you know, the best investors can change tact and just, you know, do things differently and recognize when the market's changed.
Yeah. So like I feel like if we don't touch resources, then we haven't hit every single Australian asset class that means it. Like we may as well do it, right? You know, this one of the interesting things at the Aura event was one of the questions came up and one of the guys goes, there's no way in the world it's ever gonna hit net zero, right? You know, so climate change, you know, is real, but essentially this whole net zero business and they're charging us for it is a bit of a joke. So in saying that, why I'm bringing this up, we're talking about, you know, cycles of markets, you know, like what's happening with essentially the resource space here. Like we look, a lot of the investment managers we use and you like them as well, we are heavily in the renewable stuff, which is great, but it's just kind of hurts Australia where you have like the fourth largest deposit of natural gas in the world and greenies are kind of giving you a hard time for it. Like do you think that, you know, the resources space is also going to hold up quite nicely in Australia, which also supports everything else here?
Yeah, I'm horrified that our country openly wants to hurt or disadvantage one kind of competitive edge that we have, right? It's like an own goal, right? We're letting Africa and Latin America compete against what, you know, we have a more stable jurisdiction, better legal rights, but we still feel the need to attack something that we're globally competitive in. So, you know, there's huge new iron ore mines being opened in Africa, in Guinea. Like, you know, it's horrifying. You know, the net zero thing. Look, this is going to be controversial, but you know, we do.
That's why we're here, Jason. Controversial is our friend, right? We think we go against the grain without pissing anyone off, of course.
God, this is it's been a long process, but we. I won't say where it is, because then it will be highlighting the manager who's actually done an exceptional job to recover value, right? But this power plant, you know, part solar, part gas, it's in an area where it rains a lot, so you can't just have solar. It's also not in the, like, kind of the main energy grid of, you know, Queensland, New South Wales, Victoria, and South Australia, which is actually one energy grid, and the power price goes up a lot and goes down a lot. You know, it can be negative, and that's horrible to invest. So we're actually in a really stable jurisdiction. But we haven't been able to connect it for 10 years because the intermittent nature of power, the grid stability, the idea that we can just open renewables and connect it to the grid it's not realistic. You know, and a lot of people say, oh, look, you know, my power price is going down because I've got solar. And it's like, it's not about the household. It's about the widget maker or the industrial company. And the wholesale cost of power, if you're in a low margin industry competing globally, it is a massive competitive disadvantage, energy prices in this country. And, you know, we've spent $1 trillion on renewables. Our grid is less stable. Energy prices, particularly for wholesale, are at their highest. So there needs to be an honest debate around how much more money is required and, you know, is net zero possible with renewables? You know, wind is not blowing and the sun is not shining.
Yeah, but we need to actually really get into this because this is actually a very, very important and interesting part. Like you have all this growth and demand and money back, which starts the finance side, the growth of essentially the AI, but it's picks and shovels, just like we're mining. You know, NVIDIA, these companies, they take so much energy right? And even Elon Musk on the Joe Rogan podcast came out and said that, you know, the in the States, the structure can't sustain it. It can, you know, California's having brownouts. You know, to your point, you have this fantastic asset in Australia. You can't even plug the damn thing in, right? Meanwhile, was it last year, you know, we hear stories of essentially a major, was it Apple? I can't remember who it was, purchased a data center right next door to a nuclear power station. So it's completely socially acceptable for these big institutions with huge demands for, you know, energy to essentially get access to the only nuclear power stations that are allowed. But we can't build a nuclear power station with the technology so much better than what it was, you know, in order to sustain the ever-growing demand. You know, like, what the hell is happening with energy and the actual support of the critical infrastructure we need to sustain this level of growth? What the hell's happening, Jason?
It's no coincidence that, you know, our productive capacity to grow, you know, our economy used to grow at 3-4%, right? We're one of the fastest developed growing countries in the world. We can barely grow above 1% now, right? And that's with, you know, strong population growth. So, you know, we've had consecutive quarter-on-quarter declines in per capita income. So there is a fundamental problem with how the economy is operating, and a big part of that is energy, right? It's also the crowding out of the private sector. The government has become bigger and bigger, where almost all of the jobs created have been in quasi-government roles, like the NDIS and that kind of thing. Like, the economy, you know, I don't want to be too negative because, you know, we have fantastic kids who come out of university. We have a fantastic migrant contribution to the economy. But to run a business here is hard. And so, again, I go back to that point and I look at my own portfolio. I have no large cap exposure. I just think they're a beta proxy to those issues. They're a beta proxy to weak economic growth and poor government policy and the crowding out of the private sector. But I definitely still believe that our kids, particularly our migrant population and our early stage kind of small cap VC, smaller company side, they can grow because they're less, they're labor light, they're capital light. And they can also, like, the great thing about, and again, plugging some of the groups, you know, there's a real opportunity to take an Australian company that's really good in a field and take it to the market like the US and grow rapidly, right? And that's one of the theses that really the VC team at Aura focus on. So, you know, a perfect example was there, you know, they were the first investor in Catapults before it was listed, right? And so I still am optimistic about our economy at that kind of small company and that kind of early stage. But in terms of the big, you know, macro for Australia, it's pretty depressing.
Yeah, but it's hard.
So hard to start a business.
Yeah, but it's hard, right? Who was the at Aura? Who was the lady there that from the who was the minister of that was presenting at Aura? What was her name?
She was the from the Liberal Party. So she was the nighttime economy minister.
Yeah, so she was even discussing, you know, that they definitely want the growth and all that type of stuff. But then another gentleman there even mentioned that Australia is one of the hardest parts to essentially do these startups. And I'm actually just wondering, you know, whether or not energy is one of the main problems.
No, I'll challenge you on that. No, startups is actually very good in this country. There's grants, the science and the universities is very strong. The startup ecosystem and, you know, they hate using the statistic, but Australia actually has the most number of unicorns per dollar spent, right?
Really?
So I would say the one thing that the one thing that Australia does very well is at early stage, right? We always heard about it. Like, we'd be very good at science, right? But we could never commercialize it. I still think that's the case. Like, we're really good at that early stage scientific discovery, you know, backing winners or picking winners. My fear is not around that part of the economy. That's a small part of the economy. Remember that. My fear is that we're now in this kind of low growth rut of 1.5%. You know, maximum GDP growth and living standards going down. You know, GDP per capita, GDI, gross domestic income per capita has gone backwards for, I don't know what it is up to now, but it's probably approaching 9 out of 10 quarters, right? It's abysmal. And what policies do we have to address that? We don't. Like, you know, we were going to tax unrealized gains, for God's sakes. Like, that's not a way to encourage investment. Like, we need to make it easier to set up a business. We need to make it easier to grow. We need, you know, less impediments. And we need the public sector to be less of the overall economic pie, because it is crowding out genuine growth by the public sector, by the private sector, sorry. So the crowding out, it's not spoken about a lot, but the government policies over the last decade have increasingly crowded out entrepreneurial activity in the larger companies, right? Larger companies can't grow. They can't hire people. So from my allocation, I'm entirely weighted. You know, I think the private debt markets here, I'm around in circle, are really good because of the creditor rights. Like, you know, you control everything. I definitely, and I know I keep stressing this point, I back like entrepreneurs and small companies and the VC landscape and our universities and our kids and our migrants. Like, they just have a disproportionate positive impact to that ecosystem. I'm a very macro thinker, right? It's like, I love macro. At economics, when I studied economics, I love the macro and I love investing. And I don't think you need to take an overly macro approach to everything, but you need to understand the big trends, right? You need to understand the big trends before going to an asset class. So what I love doing is mixing that kind of macro view of the world and where I invest with the opportunities that result from that.
Yeah, macro is the best. And one thing we haven't touched on, yeah, what are the big macro things? I suppose where I'm going with this is that we had a conversation a while ago. It's funny, as a financial planner, you know, there's a ticker box exercise when you're looking at a retail client where it says you must allocate, if they say they're high risk or medium or growth, you must allocate a percentage based on the textbook into Australia, right? We actually, you know, verbally challenge that, still have to do it, you know, legally. But what's the point in investing in Australia, to your point, where essentially it's, you know, return half the amount that essentially the state has? Meanwhile, there are very good fund managers out there that still have a mandate to invest anywhere in the world where it's a good company, but it appears the only decent company they see that's in Australia has been CSL for years, right? So it's like the only one of the only companies which they actually hold in these portfolios. Doesn't that speak volumes for, you know, what people perceive to be good businesses?
Look, I mean, the ASX 20 is never really, it's hard to get too excited. It's boring. Like, if I want to buy the ASX 20, I'll buy an ETF, right? But when I look at, you know, my small cap managers, and you know my small cap managers, and obviously one of them is Ellerston, I like the companies I see there, right?
Yeah.
They're growing. They're expanding. They're run by founders. They're aligned, right? There's all these characteristics. So, you know, the US market is obviously a very entrepreneurial market. And again, horrifies me, and it makes me very sad that, you know, Australia's going one way, making it harder to grow large businesses. And the US is going the other way, which is making it much easier, cutting regulation, you know, lower energy costs, you know, government getting out of people's business. It's good, right? That's how companies grow. So, you know, I think we need to, a real discussion. I mean, we had a productivity, like government had a productivity discussion, right? Like a year ago, 2 years ago, nothing came from that. Nothing came from that at all. And I'm not saying it's this government's fault, like it's multiple succession of governments that have not improved the productivity challenge in this economy.
Well, lastly, finish with Europe, because we haven't touched on there, and find Europe very interesting. Look, personally, this guy's using a fund manager where allocated quite a lot. It's been doing incredibly well the past 2-3 years, but like Lloyds Bank, Barclays, you know, the UK's just been hammering in the banking space. You know, meanwhile, Australia's been, you know, Australia. Then you're also seeing, you know, fast changing GDPs. Well, Greece fixed up the property and the black money problem, right? You know, you got Hungary and Poland, everything's exploding. So what's currently happening, you know, in the European market? If, you know, listeners, you know, have exposure to some of these, to on the European side, like Spotify, like what's happening over in Europe right now?
Look, I don't follow Europe massively. Like the Greece story is phenomenal, right? What a fantastic like change, right? From, you know, the weakest member to now being one of the strongest, right? So the reforms and the difficult reforms being in almost depression is impressive. Look, I think personally, Germany and France are structurally screwed. The French will never change. The German situation is a little bit different. They obviously, you know, new government spending a lot of money on defense, you know, really re-leveraging that economy. But still, what are they really good at, right? Like, you got to be good at something. And I'm not sure what the competitive edge, apart from being nice places to visit and scenic, I don't think a lot of these countries are good at many things. Look, I'll be honest, I'm more excited by Asia, to be honest. I see, you know, young population. I see, you know, that digital enablement of progression. Like, just think about it, like, look at Africa. I don't say Asia, but look at Africa. I think we spoke about this last time, and this is why I like frontier countries. I think frontier and Asia are really interesting places to invest. You know, digital enablement through bank accounts and phones. Like, if you think about the industrialization process, the path that these countries are taking is much shorter. So where a typical country would build some factories, build this, and it would take like 30 years to industrialize, these countries in Asia and these countries in Africa can leapfrog that technological kind of that process. And so, you know, yeah, Asia's getting old, but there's so many opportunities there. You know, particularly in a market like the Philippines, and you know, valuations are cheaper. You know, Africa is interesting as well. Very young population. India is very interesting, and then even China, despite all its problems, you know, aging population, debt levels, property market, China is still an innovation hub that I think, you know, everybody underestimated, and you know, it would be a hard bet to make to say, is it the US or is China going to win this war? Because I don't think it's clear cut. And I think right at this point, I think the China is ahead. And that's why we're seeing 80% of GDP in the US being linked to CapEx in data centers and digital infrastructure, because they know they're behind. So a lot of interesting markets out there. But when I look at Europe, just not much, right? Not much. Way better opportunities in Asia. And obviously I still like that kind of small cap space and that VC space in Australia. And then obviously you can't ignore the US. It's still a, you know, economic powerhouse.
With Asia, Asia's a very interesting one. There's a couple of fund managers we know to get access, but not many people know how to safely access the Asian growth story. I don't know if you want to make any comments around that, but it's, I suppose, from a risk management perspective, like how do you access the growth without potentially blowing yourself up?
Yeah. So I was on a panel for Aura Group. So their private equity business is based in Singapore, right? And it's kind of awkward because, you know, someone asked, you know, what's the allocation to Asia PE by Australian super funds? And I'm like, it's negligible. Like, it's virtually nothing. They all gravitate towards the bright lights of the New York or London-based managers, right? And they said, well, what has to change for that for super funds to look at Asia? I think, you know, the return profile, you know, I think the vintages in the US and Europe are probably not going to do as well as anybody expects. It's like this kind of digestion issue of companies. So, you know, I think there'll be a resetting of expectations around returns of the US market and what Europe have offered. Because remember, a lot of these companies were bought in zero interest rate environment. That will force people to look where the growth is. And I think even if economic growth in Asia is lower than what it was 10 years ago, I want to be involved in a manager that has less competition for assets, has feet on the ground. You know, you can't invest in the Philippines, you can't invest in Taiwan, you can't invest in Vietnam or Indonesia or Malaysia based in New York, right? You need people who are in those locations, India as well, right? You've got to be in these locations. Now, for me around risk, it's risk in my head. Like when I go into an investment, I know that it can go down. But the one risk I feel that I can manage is valuation risk, right? Now, you know, unless I'm selling an asset, I don't want to know that my PE fund bought an asset and there was four people in the room and my PE fund got it because they paid the higher price, right? So seller, absolutely, pay, you know, get the highest price possible. What you see in Asia is just there's just less competition for assets. So the valuation and the entry multiple you're getting in is stronger. Other ways to mitigate risk is structuring. When you've got less competition, you've got more control around structuring, put protections in, get preferential rights. You know, also, the group I work with, Aura, I mean, a lot of their assets in Asia, all of them, Anytime Fitness, Giftaway, they're all cash generative, right? They're generating cash as well. So, you know, you can call it like a less stable region, but that also creates opportunities, right? If there wasn't instability, there wouldn't be opportunities. So when we had the type order situation, you know, the type market sold off pretty heavily. But, you know, if you can look through that noise, these countries have always have been a little bit less stable. That instability, number one, keeps some investors away because they're too scared. And two, it keeps valuations in, you know, you can get a nice attractive entry point. So I think investors have to look at Asia. I think investors have to go back to China. I think investors have to look at India. And I think that's going to be the great rotation, I think, the next decade. And remember, I remember back in my early stage of my career when emerging markets were flying. Well, emerging markets had a really good year this year. But still, over the last decade, they're significantly under developed markets. Mark my word, the next 5 to 10 years, we'll see a rotation out of very expensive US large caps and out of the ASX 20. And institutional investors and family offices will increasingly look at emerging markets, at frontier economies, and also China.
Fascinating. Thanks for bringing up Asia. I nearly forgot about it, but it's so true. And now my favorite question always to ask you is, look, you speak with these family offices, you speak with these big families on a regular basis. What are they thinking about you know, the risks and where to allocate? You know, what's on their mind and how are they dealing with their investments?
Look, I think everybody's, you know, family offices have a natural competitive advantage, right? They've got time on their side. And they've often seen a lot of cycles. There's a few thematics. You know, I think families like to do what they know. So, you know, you will know this very well, property, then they're probably going to do a lot of property. Technology, then they're going to do a lot of technology. I would say one of the most interesting, and I saw this at Coda, but I didn't appreciate it, but I appreciate it a lot more, is the idea of having a legacy and giving back is a very strong theme. Very, very strong theme. Private markets is a big theme. Succession planning. You know, Australia is the, you know, one of the youngest, you know, billionaire population in the world, right? I reckon it's probably, you know, second to Silicon Valley, right? The average age of a billionaire in Sydney is very young, right? And so succession hasn't been a huge issue. How do you get kids involved? How do you get them trained up? I actually work with an amazing individual on and off, Joanna Sun, and she does a lot of the succession planning, right? And bringing kids into the business, training them up, giving them a small balance sheet to take risks. But that transfer of wealth is going to be massive, right? And I don't think the country's ever gone through that. I mean, we obviously have some second or third generation families, particularly in Melbourne, but by and large, it's a very young population for wealth. And so outside of everybody just trying to find good ideas, it's that giving aspect, it's a succession planning. There's a lot of things going on.
Look, comment about Joanna Sun. If anyone's got a family office or looking at legacy planning and how to bring the family together and you've got issues within the family, which we all do, right? Look, please reach out to Jason or myself for an introduction because, you know, Joanna, if you're out there, you're amazing. Love what you do. You've been great for all our clients and friends. But on that note, Jason, is there any other thoughts you want to leave, you know, listeners with, anything that comes to mind?
Yeah, just be flexible, talk to as many people as possible. There's always ideas. And look, I'm just very, very fortunate to be involved in this industry. It's like a privilege. You know, I've had some great mentors and some great people be involved in stuff. So yeah, it's a great industry. It's a fantastic industry. And you know, I guess the next 10 years is going to be phenomenal. It's going to be challenging. The pace of change is going to be like nothing we've ever seen. That will come with opportunities. It will come with challenges, but it's going to happen whether or not we like it or not.
Thank you very much, Jason, coming on the Rate of Change with York Wealth Management. I'll catch up with you soon. Definitely going to have you on again. Because I love chatting to you, Jason. Always interesting.
A lot of fun. Thanks, man.
Yeah.
Bye. Good to see you.
The Rate of Change podcast is presented by its speakers. The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speaker in their personal capacity and do not represent the views of York Wealth Management Proprietary Limited, its shareholders, directors, or any other third party. Any discussion of financial products, investments, credit, or property opportunities in this podcast is provided strictly for general information and discussion purposes only. Nothing in this podcast constitutes general advice, personal advice, financial product advice, credit advice, or a recommendation. Before making any financial or investment decisions, you should seek advice from a licensed professional who will consider your objectives, financial situation, and needs. Australian listeners can obtain further information about choosing a financial advisor by visiting www.moneysmart.gov.au. For clarity, the Rate of Change podcast is a business owned and operated by Murdoch Venture Capital Proprietary Limited. Any client relationship or referral that arises through the Rate of Change in connection with services outside the scope of financial services requiring an Australian financial services license, including, without limitation, private credit, property development, or other non-AFSL activities, shall remain the sole property of the Rate of Change. Where listeners wish to obtain advice in relation to their investments or other matters that fall within the scope of financial services requiring an AFSL, the Rate of Change may refer them to York Wealth Management Proprietary Limited. York Wealth Management is referenced in this podcast solely in its capacity as sponsor. References in the introduction to the Rate of Change with York Wealth Management are sponsorship acknowledgements only and do not imply ownership or control of this podcast by York Wealth Management. To learn more about York Wealth Management as sponsor, please visit www.yorkwealth.com.au.